talk on dynamics and classification. This is Dwight Wirt with Human NGOs, colleague at A&M. I guess we've heard a few talks now on dynamics and classification in the conference. I'd just like to start with a little bit of background to set the context of what I want to speak about. I guess Fuchs and Lin already mentioned some of the landmark results in this connection between dynamics and classification. So I might go back, first of all, and mention the circle algebra decomposition results, first with Putnam for cross products of minimal homeomorphisms and tensor sets, and then the Elliott-Evans decomposition, inductive limit decomposition for irrational rotation algebras and the circle algebras. And I think these two seminal results, I think we can say, provided a large part of the justification and modification, motivation for the study of inductive limits in the development of classification theory. Then Fuchsin mentioned the celebrated result of Giordano, Putnam, and Scow, classification of minimal homeomorphisms of the Cantor set up to strong orbit equivalents in terms of the order of K0 group, the cross product. And more recently, the result of Fuchsin Lin and Chris Phillips, they showed that if you start with a minimal homeomorphism of a compact metric space with finite covering dimension, and you assume the image of K0 is dense in the affine functions on traces, then you can show that the cross product has tracer rank 0 and you fall into classification results. Now, I want to keep in mind these two hypotheses in this last theorem. So first of all, you have this finite dimensionality condition on the one hand. On the other hand, you have this kind of strength inversion of 0 rank 0, if you want to think of it in that sense. So keep in mind these two conditions. These will come back in the kind of examples that I'll be discussing. Okay, so in view of these results, classification and dynamics, you might think that perhaps having a cross-product structure would give you enough regularity, kind of uniformity in the algebra structure, that you might be able to develop some kind of classification results in terms of K0, in terms of K-theory, ordered K-theory. And one thing I'd like to show today is, well, in fact, you can combine high-dimensional topological features with minimality in dynamical systems. Okay, so you can achieve some type of non-uniformity in this sense, and this is related at the dynamical level, so related to the problem, the question of having a minimal system, so some kind of irreducibility in the topological sense, but at the same time, it's sort of highly non-irreducible in the measure theoretic sense, in the sense that you have a huge number of invariant measures on the system. So this theme will also come up in the examples that I'll discuss. Okay, so of course, there's the hope of classification theory that perhaps all simple nuclear and so on separable C-square algebras exhibited enough regularity that they should be classifiable by some type of K-theoretic invariant. And this leads us to line of development that was initiated in some examples of Beilinson. So Beilinson first considered the problem of perforation and developed some topological arguments for establishing or exhibiting perforation in simple C-star algebras, simple inductive limits, then went on to apply these in the question of stable rank, but today I just want to focus on this question of perforation. So let me just quickly recall here the definition of weak unperforation for a simple ordered abelian group. So this means if you have some element such that some multiple is strictly positive, then that element must already be strictly positive. So Andrew Toms gave a nice discussion yesterday, so he illustrated the picture of K0 group of even dimensional spheres. You get perforation, and you have this nice diagram that we saw yesterday. So what Gillison showed is that he constructed, rather straightforward way, an inductive limit of matrix algebras over some product of a certain base space, certain seed space, such that the K0 group here has perforation. So this is inductive limit, and the embedding maps are straightforward. These are just diagonal embeddings. Let me put up the next slide here. A little more specifically what's going on. So many of these embeddings down the diagonal in the connecting maps, these are formed by taking quotients of the products of the space space B on the one hand, and on the other hand, you need to insert a whole bunch of point evaluations in order to arrange for simplicity in the limit. So one of the main points here, and this will come back, we'll see this in the dynamical context a bit later, so one of the points here is that even though, so you have to have these point evaluations, you sort of have to collapse or trivialize the topology a certain number of times here in order to ensure simplicity in the limit. You only need to ensure that you have sufficiently many of these point evaluations. They don't have to occur with any kind of frequency. They don't have to occur with any fixed proportion among all of these diagonal maps forming the connecting maps. Okay, so you're free, basically, to arrange a proportion as large as you want of these block projection maps, which preserve the topology, which somehow carry the non-trivial topological features which you may build into your base space D from one map to the next in the construction of this inductive limit. Okay, so here's a topology that goes into the result, and I'll use this as the key lemma of Gillotson, and I'll use this in the dynamical context. So we start with a complex 9 bundle over Bs. We could take the B to be the 2-sphere, for example, such that no tensor power of the Euler class is 0. You take the product of this bundle in itself, and then you would apply this lemma here. Gillotson shows. So if you construct an element like this in K0, so you take the n-fold product of your bundle for any n, and you subtract from it the class of a trivial bundle, trivial rank 1 bundle, line bundle. If this happens to be positive, so if this is equivalent to some other bundle on e to the nth power of our base space b, then the nth tensor power of the Euler class must be 0. So you start with the initial space, the initial building block in the inductive limit. You can start with a bundle over your base space B and look at a class in K0 of this form, so a difference of this product of the non-trivial bundle with itself and the class of a rank 1 bundle. So you can show that this remains non-positive under the connecting maps. Under the connecting maps, of course, you have a certain number of point evaluations to ensure simplicity. When you push this guy forward, that you're going to have to split off some trivial bundles of a certain rank. But the rank of those trivial bundles, which you split off, will not exceed the rank of this trivial bundle here under the push forward. And so when you push this forward under the connecting maps, you're going to get trivial bundles of larger and larger rank. But that rank there will stay above the rank of the trivial bundle, which you are required to split off on this non-trivial part of the connecting maps. Okay, and again, this has to do with the density condition on the number of block projections that you see in these connecting maps. Okay, on the other hand, a kind of general result of that splitting off trivial bundles from bundles of high rank will tell you that a certain multiple of this element will become positive. Okay, so this will produce perforation. Yes, dimension. So I'll use this as a generic notation here for a trivial bundle. I'll indicate the dimension down here if you want. Okay, so yes, so I should point out here, so the basic point of Gillotson's examples here is that you can build in higher dimensional features of higher dimensional topological spaces into a simple inductive limit in this case. Okay, so we know that, generally speaking, non-commutativity tends to destroy higher dimensional features. So you see evidence of this all over. So for example, Andrew Toms discussed the behavior of stable rank and real rank, for example, under tensor matrix algebras just becomes smaller and smaller. For example, the Elliott-Evans inductive limit decomposition of rational notation algebras, even though the phase space of your dynamical system is one-dimensional, somehow the cross product becomes, of course, some features of zero dimensionality somehow. We also see this feature in the Lynn-Phillips result as well, even though the phase space you start with may be of very large topological dimension. So again, it's just playing off of requiring that the non-trivial topological part be sort of propagated along the building blocks in the inductive limit, which we can do by density condition. just requiring that we have a sufficiently large number of point evaluations to get simplicity. Okay, so the goal here is to try and apply this lemma of Beilinson in the dynamical context. So what I want to do first, let's start with a simple shift. We start with some base space Y. Y, in general, can be a compact Hausdorff space. May have large topological dimension. And we copy it out to define a shift. So we copy it, take a product over the integers with the product topology. This defines a compact Hausdorff space, and you define a shift by shifting the index. Now, this system here is very far from being minimal, so of course it's not going to produce a simple cross product. It is transitive, so for example, if Y is a compact metric space, you'll have a dense orbit. But this is far from what we want, of course. Anyways, let's just see what we get just by looking at the shift. So you can embed, first of all, we take some sequence in our shift like this. Of course, we can map down, we can evaluate it, let's say this is the zeroth coordinate here. Right, y is zero, so this is the zeroth coordinate. We can embed C, Y, our base space, into the cross product by composing with this map, this projection on the zero coordinate, and embedding into the cross product. At the same time, we can also take our space Y and embed it into the system via fixed points, right? So you take a point Y and you just copy it out into a sequence which is entirely consisting of Y's. And because these are fixed points, you can use universal properties of cross products. You get a homomorphism there on the right side, so you can actually pass C of X right through the cross product. It doesn't really see any dynamics because you're doing this via the existence of fixed points in the dynamics. This composition, of course, just produces the identity map of C of Y. You can just pass it right through the cross product. Well, you can see here, if you have perforation in the K0 group of Y, and that's going to pass through the cross product, just for abstract reasons. Of course, talking about fixed points, again, this is very far away from something being minimal. Let's talk about simplicity. So instead of looking at fixed points, you can study more generally periodic points. And this is a little bit closer to what we're looking for in terms of minimality. For example, if you look at all periodic points in this shift, so let's say period n, it's a positive integer n. Right. And you can still produce a quotient, you can produce a square homomorphism from the cross product. The matrix out between n minus matrices over n copies, n full product of the base space Y. Again, using the universal properties of the cross product. And the dynamics over here is simply implemented by the shift matrix. And the shift matrix will simply basically reduce the coordinates in this n-fold product of the Y with itself. Now, so if we take our map and see Y in the cross product, we compose it with this map now in the matrix algorithms over the n-fold product. Y, coming from periodic points. Well, we can't see for abstract reasons whether perforation will sort of pass down here, whether we can witness perforation. On the other hand, the perforation occurs as a result of this phenomenon of the Beilinson observed, as a result of this existence of a line bundle for which no tensor power to the Euler class is zero. And we will be able to obtain a witness perforation down here. Essentially, so if you start with one of these line bundles over Y and pass it in here, so what's happening over here, well, essentially what you get is a direct sum of pullbacks of these bundles over each one of the coordinates of Y. Okay, then this condition on the potential power of the Euler class being non-zero will kick in and we'll be able to deduce witness perforation over here. Again, talking about periodic points, this is still far away from
minimality. So what we could do maybe is, instead of looking at the full shift, maybe we look at a subshift in which not all periodic points are here, but some periodic points. You may still get a map down here, except you may no longer have a product, an n-fold product of y, just some subset of that product. Now, this subset is still somehow relatively large with respect to the n-fold product of y. And you may still, if you have some kind of density condition, as in the inductive limit constructive realism, you may still be able to get this perforation using one of these elements of the type of realism as well. Okay, so this is my basic idea. Again, we're trying to use periodic points in order to get this perforation. So just doing that, looking at a subsystem with sufficiently many periodic points, again, it's not going to produce minimality. So what we're going to have to do is some kind of limit construction. So we'll construct a decreasing sequence of subshifts. We have sufficiently many periodic points to get this perforation. But in the limit, we'll be able to control things to produce minimality. So in the limit, every orbit will end up being dense, and the periodic points will simply disappear. That's the basic goal.
This example will be constructed as an inductive limit, but as you'll see, we don't know if the building blocks are something we could, the building blocks themselves are cross products, will be cross products. We don't know, for example, if they're AH or so on. Well, so a shift, like a full shift on Y is, well, this is interesting for the following reason. Let's just view it dynamically now. Let's go back to the dynamics. So the idea of the shift here is that, well, you take your base space y, and then you generate many copies of these. You distribute them in a somehow independent way with respect to the group, the integers. And then you use the dynamics somehow to relate these copies back to each other, conceptually speaking. So, for example, if you wanted to measure something about your space y, and you couldn't do it directly for whatever reason, if you wanted to measure its cardinality or its dimension and so on, what you could do is copy it out in terms of a shift and somehow measure the average growth of this quantity. If you could make some kind of statistical measurement of how this quantity you're trying to measure is growing. The dynamics gives you a mechanism for somehow measuring that quantity. And in the limits, you would, with this full shift, if you define quantities correctly, you might recover exactly via this average quantity in the limit, you may recover the actual quantity for your original space y. So this is, for example, the idea behind the definition of entropy. This is somehow a prototype for entropy. Entropy is simply measuring, in this situation, the cardinality of y. Except instead of measuring cardinality directly, you would measure it on average as you take larger and larger products and take a limit. So this recovers the cardinality. So on the other hand, shifts are not so interesting, again, as this minimality problem, apart from being minimal. So you may look at some kind of subshift such that on average you would recover some property of y, right? But at the same time, you might be able to try and arrange minimality by restricting the number of sequences which appear. So again, this is the idea. All right, so in words, here's a description of our constructions. As I said, this will be constructed. Our limit system is constructed as a sequence of subshifts. And these will be defined via a kind of blocking procedure.
Be a little more specific about that.
So this type of construction seems to be well known in dynamics, but it's rather hard to find in the literature. So this appears in a paper of Lindenstrauss and Weiss on mean dimension. The mean dimension is a kind of dimension version of entropy. So it's defined so that precisely in this kind of full shift example, the mean dimension of this type of system should give you precisely the dimension of your seed space y. So that's the idea of mean dimension. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The construction is a little bit different. I think the type of construction of subshifts and dynamics, which is much more familiar, is the procedure where you somehow exclude the type of strings that should appear in your subshift. But then the idea of a subshift of finite type, right? So you identify certain strings which should not appear in your subshift. This is somehow different. We're taking a kind of positive approach. We're trying to identify the strings which should appear in the subshift. Or more precisely, we're going to take a block of a certain length, certain product, subset of the product of the y's. We're going to look at all strings which appear inside of that product and look at all concatenations of those strings. And those are going to be the allowable strings in our subshift. So it's a kind of positive procedure. We identify the strings which should appear. Okay, so here's the blocking procedure. Okay. Product of finite many copies of our base space y. And we'll define what we call a block, which is a subset of this, like a subset of each coordinate, b1, bn, let's say there are n factors. And these are closed subsets of y, we'll call this a block. Now look at all strings which can appear inside of this block, and take all possible infinite concatenations of such strings. Those are the sequences that we're going to allow inside of our subject, which are going to define the subject. Yeah, so this is basically the experiment sequence like this. And we only require that they be blocked off in this way with respect to some phase, right? So there are different phases with respect to which they can be blocked off. For example, if we're given a sequence like this, we can realize this string inside of our block, and then this string, and so on, will not allow the sequence. But it could also be that this string here appears inside of our block, and so on, and so on. So there are n different phases with respect to which we can block off the sequence. Yeah. So we describe this in a kind of positive way, so you take all possible strings of length n inside of here, right? And then you take all possible concatenations of such strings. And then how you actually place them in terms of the time of the subscript, right, is determined up to a phase, n possible phases.
The two-sided infinite
concatenation. Yeah, two-sided infinite concatenation. If you allow for any possible phase in this blocking off, then this will form back to the closed Bajorian subset of the shift. That will result. Yeah. So there are n possible ways you could block off a given sequence. There may be different ways, you may be able to block off a single given sequence in two different ways, two or more different ways. But we'll see later on that we want to preclude that possibility. Not in this example, but later on. Also right here that we're not requiring periodicity. So you do have periodic sequences appearing inside of here. On the other hand, when we form these concatenations, you don't require any kind of periodicity. Okay. So now what I want to do is look at a kind of composition like this. So keep in mind these two special invariant sets. So X sub B is exactly the set I described, set of all sequences which can be formed by this blocking procedure. Then inside of that, you have sequences which are inside, which can be blocked off this way, but are actually periodic. Okay, so if you take these periodic sequences, you can embed the block B, which is our block B, you can embed it into our subshift X sub B just by via periodic sequences. You take a string in B and you copy it, you concatenate it in itself, you create a periodic sequence. So in this way you get this quotient of the type I've already described here, and into here over, now this will be B. So n by n matrices over our block B. Again, the dynamics is implemented by the shift matrix. So now the point here is we want to construct our block B
so that on many of these coordinates, you actually see the full space Y. So we want to be able to sustain this weather class obstruction, and we're going to require a kind of density condition on the number of Ys which are here in every subshift in our inductive limit construction. Okay, on the other hand, we're going to have to insert some points. So the blocks in our construction will be of the form, we'll have the form such that most of the Ds here, or a fixed proportion of the Ds, let's say half of them, are going to be the full space Y. The other Ds here will actually be single points. Points there are, again, these are required to be able to produce minimality in the limit. Okay, so what happens if we start with one of these bundles on our seed space Y and then pass it through this composition down into matrix algebras over a block? Okay, well then what you see then is a sum of pullbacks of the original bundle up into the block, from the coordinates back into the block, right? So if these coordinates, you have a coordinate here which is Y, you're basically just pulling the bundle back. You preserve the topology of the bundle. If you have a point, you're basically producing the trivial bundle when you pull back, even though you started with something non-trivial. So if L, if the set L of coordinates on which we have in our block, in which we have the full space Y, is sufficiently large, then you're going to see, you're going to produce a bundle over there on the right. You're going to produce a bundle which has a large part of it is going to be a product, a large product of our original bundle. Then we'll have this trivial part which we have to peel off coming from the presence of points in the block. As long as the number of coordinates here in which you see the full space Y is greater than 1/2, the proportion, then you can apply Beilinson's lemma and you will be able to produce perforation on account of this Euler class obstruction.
Okay, so that's a single subshift. We still have many periodic points. We need to show that we can piece these together to form a simple inductive limit. At the same time, we want to be able to propagate the Euler class obstruction along to the limits. Okay, so here's just to summarize the basic idea. So we start with some D. D will represent the density with respect to which Y should appear in every block, in every subshift in the inductive construction. We're going to construct a decreasing sequence of these subshifts of this block type, defined by blocks which are going to get longer and longer, subject to these conditions. So at every stage, if we fix a metric on our original shift space, at every stage we're going to require sort of a kind of approximate minimality condition, that every orbit is epsilon dense for a certain epsilon. And the epsilon, we can, because we started with a metric, we can control this in a uniform way. And the epsilon in the limit can be made asymptotically going to zero. There's no problem there. And, X is Y to the Z. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, this density condition. Okay, so the density condition is going to ensure perforation will propagate to the inductive limit. In the situation, we have continuity of the cross product with respect to inductive limits. So the inductive limit of the cross product of these things will simply be the cross product of the limit system, so the intersection of all of these systems. And condition one here will ensure that the limit system is minimal. So the way that you ensure minimality here, it's a kind of relative construction. You have to do it in one of these subshifts relative to the previous one. So that's where these points in the block come in. You have to insert these points here to force every sequence in a certain subshift in the inductive construction to sort of pass within epsilon of every sequence in the previous stage. Right? And being close within epsilon in this end inside of the shift means being close on finitely many coordinates, on a large set of finite set of coordinates.
And so by inserting sufficiently many points in here, you can force any sequence at a given stage pass within epsilon of any sequence at a previous stage. That will give you condition one there, and then eventually minimality of the limit.
Okay, so this produces perforation in K0. So after I presented this in a talk in Barcelona, Andrew Tons asked me whether, well, we could do something similar in the spirit of his example, trying to produce perforation in the Kuntz semigroup, but at the same time producing a rather simple K-theory. So can we produce simple K-theory in conjunction with perforation in the Kuntz semigroup? Okay, so the idea here is to get some example which has the same Elliott invariant as, well, in this case it's going to be an AT algebra, an approximate circle algebra, but on the other hand exhibits perforation in the Kuntz semigroup. So does not sort of fall within the scope of classification results. Puts it outside of some and includes it in future. No. Okay, so, yes, Andrew gave us a nice presentation on the Kuntz semigroup yesterday, so just quickly remind here, Kuntz semigroup is built from positive elements, so we have the notion of subequivalence, so this means A is subequivalent to B, that we can, asymptotically cut it down to A in this sense here. So we can multiply by P and T star for some element T, so asymptotically along some sequence, we can produce A, the norm limit, and we define equivalence in this way here. So A is subequivalent to B and vice versa. Then we have a natural notion of addition on this group, right, defined in this way. So we define addition on equivalence classes by putting A and B inside of orthogonal inside of some matrices and then taking the equivalent class there. So this gives us a structure which we refer to as the Kuntz semigroup. And the relevant notion of unperforation here, what we call almost being almost unperforated. So this means that if n times some element A, the multiple n of A is less than or equal to multiple B of m of B, where n is larger than b, this can only happen if a is less than or equal to b.
So the goal here is to produce an example in the spirit of Andrew Tom. So let's just recall
what Andrew constructed here. So he showed, well, in particular, he showed a bit more, but in particular, he constructed a simple AH algebra. It has the same Elliott invariant, ordered K theory with traces, some AI algebra, but with Kuntz semigroup failing to be unperforated. Then he subsequently showed, using this radius of comparison, which he discussed yesterday, you can produce an infinite number of simple AH algebras, and then, now I guess with the result he discussed yesterday, you can produce uncountably many. So we can replace that with the result he discussed yesterday. So radius of comparison, as Andrew discussed, you know, this is a kind of abstraction of the notion of dimension rank ratio, and it somehow gives you a measure of the degree of perforation which exists. We talk about our comparison. So if you look at some elements A and B in the Kuntz semigroup through the lower semi-continuous dimension function, so these are the functions on the Kuntz semigroup which come from quasi-traces, or traces in our case, by a result of Hardware. But if we look at these, on these types of states, look at A and B, if A is less than B by an amount R, then A should be less than B. Then we define the radius of comparison to be the infimum of the set of such R, to which it has R comparison. So I'm going to use the same type of blocking procedure as we did to produce perforation in K0. This time we want to ensure, though, that the cross product has rather simple K-theory. So we can appeal to some classification result for AT algebras, some range result for AT algebras. So the goal here is to produce order K0 group, which is simply the rational numbers, the usual order, and the K1 group will be isomorphic to Z.
So the main difference here is that in our base space, instead of taking Y, our base space will consist of Y, take the product of Y with some interval. So the only reason for this interval here is to provide a spacing factor to ensure that every sequence can be blocked off in precisely one way. There's only one phase with respect to which the sequence in our substrate can be blocked off. Then you can guess exactly how to use the spacing factor. You just restrict the intervals here. You make sure at every stage you produce a bunch of disjoint intervals along your block here to ensure that you have this uniqueness of phase and the description of elements. So this will have the upshot here is that this will produce, essentially at the level of K-theory, it's going to give you exactly what you see if you take the universal odometer map. This is a homeomorphism of a Cantor set, so this is of the type that comes up in the classification of Jordana Putnam of the scouts. So here I'm just describing again this blocking off procedure. So we block off, we want to be able to block off in this unique way up to phase. Okay, so we get basically these represent the phases with respect to which we can block off a given sequence, then we're essentially looking at some cyclic permutation of a collection of disjoint closed sets, right? So essentially what we're doing here is somehow combining two extremes of dynamical behavior. And so it typically happens in dynamics that you have these kinds of dichotomies between some kind of mixing on the one hand, so some kind of randomness, and on the other hand you have kind of compactness or tameness, where you have a lot of structure. So this idea recurs in dynamical systems, in topological dynamics and measurable dynamics. And here we're basically combining phenomena which occur at really the farthest extremes, right? So we have at the level of K-theory and also the dynamical level, we have this universal odometer, which is perhaps the tamest type of map you could possibly construct. It's actually rotation on a compact group, so it has a high degree of rigidity, sort of algebraic rigidity, no possible mixing or anything like that. On the other hand, you want to create this kind of high-dimensional feature, which is going to necessitate, for example, infinite entropy, but even more than that, you have some kind of entropy at a kind of dimensional scale. So you have a huge amount of randomness which can't be seen by K-theory. So K-theory will only see the somehow tame parts. Okay, so again, we carry out this kind of inductive limit procedure, so we take a decreasing sequence of these subshifts constructed by the blocking procedure. You ensure approximate minimality conditions on the limit to get minimality and so on. So how do we produce perforation? Well, this is simply following the idea of Andrew. So we want some contractible, because we want the simple case here, we want to start with some contractible base space Y. But what we want to do is embed sphere or some product of spheres into this. And we want to take this non-trivial bundle, this bundle with the Euler class properties on the sphere. We also want to embed that along with it into the cube. So we're going to take Y to be the cube. We want to embed the sphere into that. Of course, you can't extend this bundle to the whole cube because the cube is contractible. But you can extend it to a positive element via partition of unity, such that when you restrict back to this embedded cube, you'll recover your non-trivial bundle. So this is the essential point. So now when we map down the matrix algebra, try and witness the perforation down here, we can further restrict to this embedded sphere, and you will notice the perforation down there. We map all the way down to our embedded sphere. So here quickly is the argument. So we require a certain condition. So if we want to produce, say, radius of comparison Q or Q minus 1, we need a condition on the density with respect to which the full space Y appears in the block.
Okay, so with this condition, you can apply the lemma of Yenitsin and some, an argument of Andrew Toms, to show that you get this uniform lower bound in every subshift on, which is going to guarantee the perforation in the Queen semigroup at every stage. Because of this uniform lower bound and the norm difference between sort of any cutdown of this bundle with respect to the trivial bundle, in the limits, the perforation is going to be sustained in the Kuhn semigroup. Okay, so if we started with two elements A and B, so B is constructed via this partition of unity starting from this non-trivial bundle on sphere, then A is a trivial bundle, then you can witness this lower bound on the radius of comparison. In this case, by minimality, the trivial states all arise from invariant measures, so by definition of the associated states on the Kuhn semigroup, you get this lower bound of Q, when you push forward B, coming from the Euler class construction, and on A just initially, it just started as a rank 1 trivial bundle on our initial space. That will just evaluate Q1. So this will produce a lower bound for the radius of comparison in the limit of Q minus 1. So what is the K-theory of these things? Well, as I basically already hinted, you get exactly the same K-theory in a kind of canonical way as what you would get from the universal odometer map. So this just falls within the sort of the classification of Giordano, Putnam, and Scow. You get exactly, applying the Pinsker-Voigt-Leschke sequence, you get exactly the same type of sequence. Let me just put that up. So K1 of our space, of our limit space, is simply going to be 0. The Pinsker-Voigt-Leschke sequence will reduce to this type of exact sequence. You can show that what you get in the limits is an extension of the universal odometer. And compute the K-theory in that case to the universal odometer. I'm calling W the universal odometer map to compute the K-theory there. Well, you can view W as a Cantor set, so you can view its K0 as a set of continuous integer value functions. And then by the Pinsker-Voigt-Leschke sequence, you can realize K0 of these cross product there, quotients, continuous integer value functions by these elements of the form F as opposed to the difference of F with its composition under the dynamic, under the inverse of the homeomorphism. And while this universal odometer is uniquely ergodic, has a unique invariant state, you can use some arguments related to ergodicity to show that, in fact, the closed class of the function in here is determined by its value on the unique invariant state. So the consequence here is that you can describe the order K theory, it's simply going to be the rationals with the usual order. K1 is going, by virtue of being a cross product here, in the Pinsker-Voigt-Leschke sequence, the K1 group is going to be the integers. Right, so you're going to get a whole bunch of invariant, a huge number of invariant measures, so a huge number of trivial states. On the other hand, the K-theory is rather simple, so the pairing between K-theory and traces is basically going to be trivial in this case because you have a total order, K0. So by a range result of Yenitsin, this inductive limit that we've constructed, the cross product in the limit is going to be isomorphic. It's going to be, have the same Elliott invariant as some simple AP algebra, but will not be isomorphic to it. So we've shown a lower bound for the radius of comparison, that you can get arbitrarily large lower bounds. On the other hand, we don't know if the radius of comparison is ever finite. Okay, so for example, we don't know if you haven't been able to construct two cross products with the same Elliott invariant, but which are non-isomorphic. So if you could show the radius of comparison was finite, you'd be able to make this type of conclusion, for example. Then, as I said, this construction will produce a huge number of invariant states, trivial states on the cross product. Well, more precisely, we'll have uncountably many extreme trivial states in this situation. the one conclusion you can make from this is that, well, the cross product is not going to have real rank zero. Okay, so I mentioned, what's the connection here with mean dimension? You can also make this conclusion, at least if Y has non-zero topological dimension. The proposition up there you can conclude by some results relating to mean dimension. So mean dimension is a kind of measure of the dimension growth in the dynamical system, the topological level. If you have uncountably many extreme traces in the cross product or invariant measures, then the system must possess what's called the small boundary property. And this implies, well, okay, so if you have non-zero mean dimension, the system will not have the small boundary property. And this will imply that it does not have countably many extreme invariant states. If you only have countably many extreme invariant states, you have this kind of small boundary property. So I won't define it almost out of time here. So the small boundary property is a kind of dynamical version of zero dimensionality. Okay, so here's another question. What's the relationship between mean dimension and radius of comparison? So already, even though we can't determine whether the radius of comparison is even finite in any of these examples, we can say that the relationship here is not perhaps the most direct one. Okay, so in the construction, in order to get this larger and larger lower bounds on the radius of comparison, you have to crank up the density in the blocks and the appearance of Y in the blocks. That's necessary to get the perforation, the Euler-Klebs construction argument to work. On the other hand, to increase the mean dimension, you simply have to increase the dimension of Y. You don't have to touch the density with respect to Y appears. Okay, so there is some kind of discrepancy between these. I mean, it's not the most direct relationship. Another question here, so the answer seems to be yes. Is there a uniquely ergodic minimal homeomorphism whose cross product has non-zero radius of comparison? Okay, so if you have positive mean dimension, well, it's not going to be uniquely ergodic. So if you have zero mean dimension, so it would seem, talking to Chris, that perhaps this result with Fosheen-Lin is probably still going to be valid in that situation. So you would expect to get, in the zero mean dimension case, some kind of classifiability result. So the answer here is probably
zero mean dimension and when the theory suggests real zero.
Right. So in the uniquely ergodic case.
Well, not quite. Well, because it wouldn't do anything for things that look like minimal homeomorphisms of spheres.
Right. Okay, even though uniquely ergodic.
The uniquely ergodic and the map of, say, zero to
okay, so you have one trace in this case, right?
Yes.
So you need the map, okay. So the map into the reals, right. Okay,
yes.
So there's still a bit of room there, a little bit of window then.
Probably not really, but
okay. Okay, so maybe I should end there. No, it's some monster. It's practically uncomputable. Yeah. Any more? Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's extremely hard. Yes. Because we know nothing about being able to decompose these into even any type of type 1 C-star algebra. So even though it's an inductive limit construction, every building block itself is a cross product, and we don't know how to decompose those. And there you're basically at a loss if you're trying to get an upper bound on the radius of comparison. So I don't know what to say there.
No,
we know nothing. So our original goal was to be able to say something about stable rank. So in particular, addressing this example here, we don't know what the stable rank is. So the type of argument that Billiton uses, which also applies to Andrew's example, so this really requires the kind of inductive limit structure, if I recall, to deduce stable rank 1. So I don't know what the stable rank is.
do we have to turn up the density of the blocks to get higher rates of comparison?
That's right, yeah, so.
Should also be able to get a higher rate of comparison, the dimension Y is bigger as well. It'd be bigger and bigger, higher and higher dimensions, too.
Yeah, that's what we're doing, but even though you do that, you still have to crank up the density in order to get this, this inequality. No, I had it up on some slide. Yeah, it sounds a little bit strange, but yeah, so it's not this direct relationship to mean dimension somehow. That's what it appears.